May it please the court, Marilyn Kirst for the Federal Trade Commission. I've reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
The question before the court today is whether the district courts must follow the standard that this court set forth in the Hines case. The Hines standard governs how the district courts are to treat applications for preliminary relief to maintain the status quo when the Federal Trade Commission is seeking to investigate and potentially block a merger. Hines made clear that injunctive relief in this circumstance is, quote, to be broadly available to the commission. And it analyzed in some detail the underlying statutes, the purposes of Section 7 of the Clayton Act to arrest mergers that may be anti-competitive in their incipiency. It also analyzed Section 13B of the Federal Trade Commission Act, which allows the commission to come to the district courts seeking an order to maintain the status quo. And it made clear that the district court's role is that.
Well, it's not automatic, right?
No, Your Honor, it's not automatic.
If a product market's not adequately shown, can injunctive relief, preliminary injunctive relief, be granted then?
Your Honor, the standard is to show that there are serious, substantial, difficult, and doubtful questions.
Well, he cited the standard several times in his opinion.
Yes, Your Honor. The district court quoted the correct standard.
Several times.
Right. You're right, Your Honor. It also, when it was describing the applicable standard, mixed in case law from the Eighth Circuit, which is directly at odds with this court's standard in Hines.
Well, but, and also the court's conclusion, its ultimate conclusion is that, quote, there's no substantial likelihood that the FTC can prove its relevant market.
Your Honor, then.
Isn't that the right, doesn't that by definition incorporate the Hines standard?
Your Honor, the Hines standard sets the substantial likelihood at the serious substantial level. And what the district court is to look at is whether there is a fair ground for investigation and study and deliberation and determination by the Federal Trade Commission in the first instance. It's definitely not a rubber stamp standard, but at the same time, it doesn't ask the district court to decide the case on the merits, as in some respects this district court appears to have assumed was its responsibility. And it also does not allow the district court to impose, as the district court did here, a burden to prove.
I don't think that's a fair characterization of what the district court did. I mean, the district court did a thorough job trying to find out what the facts were to make, then analyze it under the appropriate standard. I don't see how the district court could avoid getting deep into it, which you seem to be critical of.
Your Honor, we're not critical of the district court's attention to detail in that respect. What happened, though, was that the district court picked, for instance, one expert to believe rather than the other, rather than recognize, rather than look at the bulk of what our expert said, and at least recognize that a serious, substantial question was raised.
Suppose you had a case where, suppose it was just one expert on each side, and you could look at the two experts and easily conclude that the FTC's expert was simply wrong. Can the district court do that?
Your Honor, if the district court were to conclude something like that, it would certainly need to leave a trace in the opinion, and more than just a trace, of having considered the expert whose testimony it was rejecting. Here, the district court ignored five of the seven econometric studies that the commission's expert performed. And it simply jumped from a quick discussion of two of the studies into a full-blown adoption of exactly what Whole Foods expert testified.
Suppose, and I'm not saying this is what I think, but suppose we could look at those studies and say, yes, the district court should have considered them, but looking at them ourselves right now, we can tell that they wouldn't in any way detract from the experts of the defendant. Can we do that?
Your Honor, the review that's applicable here, certainly if Your Honors are looking at the factual issues in the record, to pick an expert, one expert or the other, I would submit would simply trace the same error that the district court did, which is instead of looking at whether the commission has met the Hines standard of raising serious substantial issues, the court would be applying a plenary review standard. Which expert do we choose to credit?
Weren't talking about the same thing, right? I mean, the one expert was talking about prices. Is there evidence that Whole Foods charged higher prices in markets without wild oats than it did in markets with wild oats?
Your Honor, it's not that one expert talked about prices and the other one didn't.
Can you answer that question, though?
Yes, there is evidence. The most salient evidence involves not wild oats itself, but a similar regional
operator. Right, not wild oats.
Not wild oats.
So
that's
the answer to the question,
correct.
I think, is no.
Your Honor, there is price evidence relating to the effect of Whole Foods, of wild oats entry on Whole Foods of Whole Foods entry on wild oats.
But not the converse. Right?
Not the converse. You're right.
That's a big hole.
Your Honor, the experts have to deal with the evidence that they are given. The number of what economists call natural experiments in the data available was not great. And so
it was not what?
I'm sorry?
It was not what?
Great.
Oh, great.
Not large. That is, wild oats did not enter markets that contained Whole Foods. And Whole Foods did enter markets that contained wild oats, and to the extent
you could have compared prices that Whole Foods was charging in markets without wild oats compared to markets with wild oats. Couldn't that have been done?
Your Honor, those studies, there was difficulty with the price data, which the commission's expert explained extensively. The price data were contaminated.
Isn't price key here to determining what the market is?
Your Honor, price is key. And what the commission's expert did was to use price data where possible, where there was enough of it, and where it could be decontaminated.
You're talking about Murphy,
right? Yes, sir. Uh-huh. Where that was not possible, what the commission's expert used was profit margin data. And the expert explained that you have to use this data carefully, you have to cross-check it with the documents in the record and make multiple studies, but that margin data is probative of price. And what Professor Murphy was able to show from margin data is that Whole Foods margins are lower, and this is in the joint appendix at page 600, that Whole Foods margins are lower in areas where a wild oats is present locally. And that was one of the seven studies. The expert, Professor Murphy, made clear that what you had to do was look at the totality of his studies, and what he concluded using those studies and using his review of the actual documents in the case was that his prediction was that this merger would lead to a 1-2% price increase, which...
What about Sheffman's research, which shows that the prices were the same for Whole Foods, whether a wild oats was present or not?
Your Honor, Dr. Sheffman's research consisted of a one-day sample after the merger had been announced, after the litigation had been filed. So this is the kind of evidence that is so eminently manipulable by the parties that it shouldn't be given weight at all. And on top of that, Dr. Sheffman's study was contrary to the documentary evidence that indicated that Whole Foods had price zones and specifically competed by on price with certain discounts or certain sales that Wild Oats was offering in certain local markets.
Well, didn't the evidence show that Whole Foods competed against all supermarkets? I mean, price checked supermarkets and made site decisions based on all the supermarkets. The supermarkets are selling the same kinds of products that Whole Foods and Wild Oats do.
Your Honor, supermarkets sell food, and Whole Foods and Wild Oats sell food. The question is, are these uniquely close competitors such that the removal of one can be predicted to have an anti-competitive
effect? Well, if they weren't
effect?
Close competitors, you wouldn't expect Whole Foods to be price-checking so carefully what's going on at Safeway or Giant or Kroger's or Vons.
Your Honor, the kind of price checking that's at issue, and this was discussed by Dr. Sheffman, the other side's expert, at page 3076 of the joint appendix, this price checking was largely taking a selection of products. They called it the Known Value Initiative, and there was a similar effort at Whole Foods, at Wild Oats. This price checking would take a small number of products, a gallon of milk, a quart of orange juice, that price-sensitive customers are going to be able to remember from one store to another, so that if you compete on those known value items where customers are most price-sensitive, then you may be freer to price your other items, the items that the conventional stores don't offer or don't offer the same quality or number of varieties of, you may be freer to price those other items much higher. And that's what Professor Murphy's studies showed that in the areas of commerce or in the areas of the products that Whole Foods offered that were its specialty, the specialty meats and varieties of produce and so on, its margins, its profit margins were considerably higher than in those commodities where price-sensitive customers do check prices.
What concerns me about your position is how different this is from the Staples case. In the Staples case, right, there was information that showed that prices were much higher where there was not another superstore in the area as opposed to where there was. And we don't have anything like that here.
Your Honor, we do to the extent that we can look at...
It's 13% difference in the Staples case.
Right? Your Honor, the difference in the Staples case was more dramatic, but so were the price profit margins in the Staples case. It's a completely different industry. And as Whole Foods expert Dr. Sheffman himself agreed, the profit margins in this industry are very, very low. Price differentials are very, very low. And so small differences are highly meaningful. So we have a situation that is in some ways similar to Staples because we do see pricing effects that depend on whether Wild Oats and Whole Foods are together in a market or have competition from another premium natural and organic supermarket, or whether their only competition is from retailers outside that market, like conventional markets or Trader Joe's or something. We have evidence showing those effects. It's not as dramatic as in Staples, and the reason is the profit margins are so different in the two industries, you're just not going to get big numbers.
Do we have any evidence of what the margins are at other supermarkets? Because the argument is that's really the market.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that this is in the record or not. I believe anecdotally that the profit margins at Wild Oats and Whole Foods, or especially at Whole Foods, were significantly higher than the margins in conventional supermarkets. I'm not certain that that is in the record, however.
What about the evidence that Wild Oats prices were uniformly higher than Whole Foods?
Your Honor, that evidence seems to disregard one of Wild Oats' main methods of competing, which was to have spot discounts and coupons and specials in its stores. But notwithstanding that, it doesn't matter whether Wild Oats' prices were lower or higher. What we have in the record is evidence that Wild Oats was looking to compete more effectively and on price with Whole Foods before the merger interrupted that. We have evidence that Whole Foods was engaged in this merger, and it was the biggest transaction in its history, specifically in order to avoid nasty price wars with Wild Oats. You can't avoid a nasty price war with someone who is not a close competitor. If the market were what Whole Foods contends it is, the all supermarkets, you couldn't avoid nasty price wars by acquiring Wild Oats. You'd have to do something much more dramatic than that. The evidence that the district court ignored.
I don't understand that last point.
I'm sorry.
If you want to avoid nasty price wars, you'd have to do something more dramatic.
The statement that acquiring Wild Oats would allow Whole Foods to avoid nasty price wars assumes that there is a uniquely close competition between them such that there would be
I think you were making the point that that's not going to work to avoid the nasty.
It would not work. You could not avoid nasty price wars by acquiring Wild Oats. If
and
the
that's
market
because
were
you're
as,
in competition with all the supermarkets.
If the market were what Whole Foods contends it is.
There.
I'm sorry?
I think you're making the other side's point there.
No, Your Honor. And if it seems that way, I apologize. Mm-hmm. The statement of Whole Foods' chief executive that acquiring Wild Oats would allow Whole Foods to avoid nasty price wars, those would be nasty price wars with Wild Oats. If it were trying to avoid nasty price wars with all supermarkets, then an acquisition of Wild Oats would not do the trick. That was all I was trying to say.
Okay. I do want to go back to, because I think it's key to what you were saying about the standard that the district court is to apply. I assume you're not saying that the district court could not make a determination of credibility as among experts. Or are you?
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that because the district court saw the experts and so on. It's just that the district court needed to tie this back to not a determination of whether the commission had met a burden to prove relevant product market, but rather whether the commission had raised serious substantial issues on the merits. And the relevant product market question is not the sole question to be considered in evaluating a market.
It
as
is,
this court,
no, it is if there's no separate market.
Your Honor, this
right.
court, no, Your Honor,
no?
There are different ways of approaching analysis of a merger. One is the sort of structural relevant product market analysis that you see in the Brown Shoe case. That's very historical. And you see that in Section 1.1 of the merger guidelines. But as this court made clear in the Baker Hughes case, the ultimate question really is the resulting company going to be able to exert market power? Is it going to be able to raise prices or reduce output or reduce quality? And what and
that
what
depends
well,
on
let
what
me,
the market is.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Your Honor, the expert testimony that the commission offered works whatever the relevant product market is considered to be, because it is evidence of direct price effects.
But if there isn't a separate market, then how could Whole Foods raise its prices?
That's the question, Your Honor. If Whole Foods' prediction is that it can avoid nasty price wars, meaning charge more than it would under competitive circumstances, then it is predicting.
But suppose the evidence, just assume that the evidence clearly showed there was no separate market for premium organic foods. Okay? Let's just assume that that was perfectly clear. Would there still be a case?
Yes, Your Honor. And that comes directly from Baker Hughes.
Okay.
Where there is a better way of showing whether the resulting entity will be able to exert market power, Baker Hughes teaches that one should use it. The relevant product market analysis is a mechanism, it's a method, it's one way of analyzing a merger. It is not the only way. And Baker Hughes makes that clear. Hines also makes that clear, that ultimately what what the court must look at, and this is when you get down to the merits, when you're really in the plenary adjudication, what do we predict will happen? Will the resulting entity be able to raise prices or lower quality?
Well, let me try to ask you this another way. The district court judge here said that if the defendants are merely differentiated firms operating within this larger relevant product market of supermarkets, then the merger would pose no threat to competition.
Your Honor, the district court was mistaken in saying that.
Okay. So you don't agree with that?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Now, so do you have, you are disagreeing with which? That there would be no competitive harm if the market was supermarkets? Or that you disagree with the definition?
We're disagreeing with the district court's statement that in a differentiated product market, you can't have anti-competitive effects from the merger of two uniquely close competitors. The DOJ FTC guidelines at section 2.2 explain how this is, that differentiated product markets are more difficult to analyze. They tend not to have very, very sharp boundaries. And so you're looking at the relative closeness of competition, whether there is uniquely close competition between the merging parties or not. And so when the district court said, this is a differentiated market, therefore there can be no harm, therefore there can be no relevant product market, that, Your Honor, was mistaken.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. What this case is about is that actual marketplace behavior contradicted the inferences that the FTC wanted to draw from some of the evidence before them and suspicions they had about that evidence. Now, the actual marketplace behavior I'm referring to is behavior of customers, behavior of competitors, and the parties themselves. The contradictions were inherent in the evidence put forward by the FTC, their own expert, and third-party supermarket competitors who were named by the FTC as witnesses. Where you have actual marketplace behavior contradicting inferences and suspicions, there is not a serious and substantial question.
Well, what's your reaction to the FTC's argument that the district court could not possibly have answered the question correctly if you didn't even consider much of their evidence?
The district court did consider their evidence. On the point of Dr. Murphy.
You don't agree that he did not consider many of their studies?
No, I do not agree with that. He did not cite each and every one of their studies in his opinion.
Right, but the commission's point is that if the standard is, has the commission raised serious and substantial questions, then the district court can't answer that unless it evaluates the FTC's evidence.
But Your Honor, the FTC
argument is that he didn't do that.
The district court judge did do it. In fact, the FTC made the same totality of the studies
said,
argument.
The FTC, you heard counsel, she said that six or seven of their key studies are not considered in the district court's decision.
That's not correct, Your
That's
Honor.
Correct?
If you look to page 36 of Judge Friedman's opinion,
every study
he didn't cite each one. He responded.
Excuse me. That's my point. Did he? Let me ask you this. Suppose, would you agree that if he hadn't discussed the studies, that he wouldn't have satisfied his burden, his standard of review?
No, I don't agree that he's obligated to discuss each study. He is obligated to make findings and facts and conclusions of law, but he's not obligated to address each and every point of evidence that he does not feel is consistent.
How can you answer the question as to whether the FTC has raised serious and substantial questions unless he considers the FTC's evidence?
Yeah. Well, here
this
I think he...
This isn't like your standard APA case, right, where we can look at the evidence ourselves and find out whether there's substantial evidence to support the decision, where the decision is actually on the merits. Here it's a different standard.
Yeah, this is a different standard.
Right.
If you go to page 36 of Judge Friedman's opinion, he responded to the argument we just heard from Ms. Kirst earlier that the sum total of Dr. Murphy's studies taken together were relevant. The FTC made that argument. Judge Friedman addressed it specifically and said that the problem with that argument was the sum total of those studies taken together were inconsistent with the credible evidence in the record about what was actually going on in the marketplace.
He didn't. Murphy at Murphy says that Joint Appendix 504-06. He says there are five occasions on which when Whole Foods opened up near Wild Oats and Wild Oats reduced prices. Now, that's not discussed by the district court.
That's not discussed, you're correct, Your Honor.
Right.
But if you back down.
There are emails from Whole Foods employees that Whole Foods occasionally lowered prices when there were nearby Wild Oats stores, not mentioned by the district court. There's the Hartman study. It says that Whole Foods won't, this is Whole Foods' own evidence. Whole Foods won't encounter any significant competition from the traditional.
Can I take those 3 points in reverse?
These just aren't mentioned in the district court's decision.
Well, let me take the Hartman study as a great example of why the district court did not cite every single piece of evidence that the FTC relies on. The study in question involved interviews of 36 people spread across six cities, and they were asked questions about three private label products, block cheese, pasta sauce, and tortilla chips. From the reactions of those 36 people spread across six cities, some of whom spent 70% or more of their grocery dollars at Whole Foods, and others whom split their purchases between Whole Foods and Safeway, those 36 people were the basis for the conclusion by the Hartman Group that other supermarkets could not compete with Whole Foods and organics. That is not a serious and substantial question.
But whose judgment? Is that the FTC's judgment or the district court's judgment?
It's the district court's judgment.
But how do we know that's what the district court did? He didn't say that.
He didn't say that. He didn't have to say that. If you look at what he did say and how he analyzed the market evidence before him, you have the basis for affirming his conclusions, because the actual marketplace behavior, the pricing evidence, the behavior of consumer shopping contradicts the suspicions the FTC would like to draw out of inadequate studies like the Hartman Group study.
Well, one of the things that the judge said here was that the FTC had not met its burden to prove the market definition. And of course, at this point, they don't have to prove it. So doesn't that show he didn't really understand the standard?
No, I think the FTC has misread Judge Friedman on that point. The burden that the FTC had was to raise serious and substantial.
Let me just read it to you. Quote, the FTC has not met its burden to prove that premium natural and organic supermarkets is the relevant market. Right.
Its burden is set by Heinz as raising serious.
What I just read you is not their burden, correct? That's not the FTC's burden under Heinz.
The FTC's burden is to raise serious and substantial questions about their market definition.
So when the district court says the FTC has not met its burden to prove that premium natural and organics is a separate market, that's not the standard, is it?
No, it's not. We don't believe the district court was not forcing them to prove the relevant market.
I was just reading to you from what the district, that was what Judge Brown asked you. I was just reading you the quote from the district court. Your answer to her question was, we're misreading what the district court said. So I responded by reading to you what the district court said. And he says,
But
the FTC has not met its burden to prove.
Yeah. And my response, Your Honor, is that its burden in a 13B action is defined by the statute as interpreted by Heinz.
Which is to raise serious and
substantial questions.
Not approved.
Right. The FTC has a burden of proof under 13B. 13B says you must raise serious and substantial questions about a Section 7 violation.
Is it your position that that sentence is an accurate representation of the FTC's burden?
My position is the FTC's burden.
Why don't you just answer my question? I read you the sentence. Is that sentence an accurate representation of the FTC's burden under the law.
Yes, I mean, the sentence is accurate.
It is?
But
it's incomplete, right?
It needs to be read in context of the 13E case.
What you're saying is that prove sufficient to raise a serious and substantial question.
What do they have to prove?
Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yes, thank you, Judge Kavanaugh. What the FTC has to prove is a serious and substantial question about a Section 7 case, the framework of which is defined by this Court's decision in Baker Hughes. There has to be a product market, a geographic market. There's a process for raising a presumption of adverse effects and rebutting it. That's what they have to prove. Product market is part of that burden of proof. So I think the sentence is accurate, but I think the way they are reading it is inaccurate.
Well, let's talk a little more about the record. Let's go back to Dr. Murphy. Joint Appendix 515. He says traditional supermarkets have difficulty competing on organic and natural foods. He says if they offer too much food, too much, he said they can't sell enough and it spoils. And if they only offer some, they can't get enough customers. Not mentioned by the district court.
Correct. The district court mentioned the testimony of actual supermarket operators who testified that they do carry these products and sell them with great success.
In the testimony, that under the law, it seems to me, it's up to the FTC to resolve, not the courts.
Well, Dr. Murphy was qualified as an expert economist, not an expert on supermarket procurement.
Did the district court tell us that?
No, he did not.
No, what about the testimony from the Safeway CEO that Whole Foods and Wild Oats are niche operators in this specialized natural food market, while Safeway, Kroger, and the others aren't? No mention of it.
No mention of it.
You see, my point is that you need to help me understand how, with this standard the district court has, that the FTC has, of raising serious and substantial questions, how a district court can resolve that question if he doesn't discuss the FTC's evidence. I can understand if there were two studies and one was, the defendant's was totally solid and the FTC's you could look at and just see made no sense, and you could explain that it didn't make sense because the expert wasn't properly qualified or because he didn't check with enough people or whatever. That I understand. But what I don't understand is how the district court can satisfy its obligation if it doesn't look at the FTC's evidence.
Well, there's no evidence the district court failed to look at the evidence.
The only thing we know is what he discussed in his decision.
That's correct.
Right?
And we know what he discussed in oral argument with counsel and his questioning of the experts during the hearing.
Were discussed.
Correct. In a simpler case with a smaller record, this court might expect the district court judge to discuss each and every piece of evidence. In this case, each side submitted, I believe, over 800 documentary exhibits. The findings of fact and conclusions of law that were submitted by each party were voluminous. The court went through those. If you look at the court's findings, you'll see that the court has adopted, in some cases verbatim, findings of fact from each side and incorporated them into the opinion.
Let me ask you the standard another way. Judge Posner articulated the district court's obligation. This was at the merits stage. He says that district court's decision to decide whether the FTC's evidence is, quote, so implausible, so feebly supported by the record, that it flunks even the deferential substantial evidence test.
Yeah, I would argue that's a different standard of proof than under 13B.
That's later down the line, so wouldn't the standard here be even more deferential?
Well, no. I mean, there is deference accorded to a final determination by the Federal Trade Commission.
But at this point, the standard isn't even, we aren't even evaluating merits determination. We're simply evaluating the question of whether or not they raised substantial questions.
We have a complaint, we have a motion, and we have a district court judge who's obligated by Congress to perform a gatekeeper role here and to exercise independent judgment about whether there is a serious and substantial question. There is no deference because there is no final adjudication by the FTC.
I'm not sure that makes sense.
I don't think that's right.
I mean, the standard can't be more deferential to the FTC later because you'll never get to that.
Exactly. Look, let me give you another example of what concerns me. The district court did consider the Murphy study about the opening of wild oats of stores near each other and the study in North Carolina, right?
Yes.
He did do that. And the district court rejected it because he says, quote, he's unwilling to accept the assumption that the effects on wild oats of Whole Foods entry provide a mirror from which predictions can be made about the effects on Whole Foods from wild oats' future exit. Okay?
That's correct.
That sounds like fact-finding to me. That sounds like, to me, that's the kind of judgment the FTC is supposed to make on the merits, and then the court would review later. But at this stage, doesn't that sound to you like, instead of asking whether the FTC's Murphy study raises substantial questions, serious and substantial questions, the district court went beyond that and made factual findings?
Now, Your Honor, the district court was chosen with making an evaluation and a choice between an assumption and evidence about market behavior. In that circumstance, the district court judge is obligated under Hines to make a judgment, not a finding of fact that the FTC is wrong, but that they have failed to raise a serious and substantial question by putting an assumption up against actual evidence about pricing, about Wild Oats prices being higher, about Whole Foods prices not varying based on the presence or absence of wild oats, on actual evidence of how Whole Foods behaves in response to other competitors.
Well, now, let me ask you about that. You rely very heavily on studies which show that Whole Foods pays attention to the prices of the traditional stores, traditional supermarkets, right?
We do rely on that.
And that there are customers of Whole Foods who shop at both stores, right?
Yes.
Okay. Is that evidence, is that kind of evidence necessarily inconsistent with the existence of a separate market for premium and natural foods?
Mere shopping alone is not, but Your Honor, we have evidence that the Whole Foods customers are shopping at other supermarkets, right, buying the very same products at those other supermarkets that they buy at Whole Foods, and spending more of their grocery dollars at these other supermarkets.
Assume for a minute that just assume that the situation was that 50% of Whole Foods products were premium and natural, you know, this alleged specialized market. But the rest of it, it's, you know, it's a regular supermarket, right? They're competing with Safeway. So the fact that people go back and forth or that Whole Foods checks the prices of Safeway doesn't really undermine the FTC's argument that there is, in fact, a separate market. All that could be going on, and there still might be a separate market for premium and natural foods.
Well,
Isn't that true?
Well, the alleged market here is the stores, not the products sold in the stores. That is a conceptual difficulty with their case. They are not alleging, in fact, Dr. Murphy expressly disavowed trying to define markets around particular departments within the store or subsets of products within the store. The allegation is that the premium natural organic supermarket, a form of supermarkets, is in and of itself a relevant product market, separate and apart from the 34,000 other supermarkets in the United States.
Mm-hmm. No.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, I think we took you well over your time. Thank you. Does counsel have any time left? You can take 2 minutes. What's your reaction to this last statement?
To the statement of
that you don't look at a market within the store, you're looking at the whole store.
Your Honor, what we have alleged is that you look at the whole store, that it is the totality of the offering, the unique combination of features.
So you agree with counsel?
We agree, but with one caveat, and that is that it is informative to look at the high profit margins in those areas in which these premium natural and organic supermarkets specialize, the things that they consider to be their hallmark products that are better, more varied, et cetera, than others.
Aren't the supermarkets selling those things that are considered to be the hallmark products?
You know, they are selling them in a limited fashion and
in growing fashion, right?
Your Honor, actually,
how relevant is that? The dynamic marketplace that Whole Foods is operating in, how is that relevant at all?
The dynamic is relevant, and
how do we take that into account?
Well, one thing that is very salient is that if you look at the testimony, and I have to be a little careful because some of this is under seal, but if you look at the testimony that Judge Tatel was referring to.
Should I not have referred to that?
No, Your Honor, I think that was okay. but that particular person goes on, and we cite this in our brief on page 14, to talk about how different and unique Whole Foods is and how we can't go toe-to-toe with them. We can capture.
That's what happens all the time with product differentiation, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Someone comes in with some new idea to sell a product in a new way. You know, better service, cleaner stores,
yes,
better location, and then the other ones, the behemoths, say, hey, that upstart's making a lot of money doing it that way. We're going to do it that way, too.
But, Your Honor, the
and
evidence.
Here the answer is the premium and organic products, right?
But, Your Honor, the evidence here shows that conventionals have made efforts and have essentially retreated from them or have made only
really?
Limited efforts.
Where's
yes,
that?
Your Honor. If you look at if you look at Whole Foods brief, page 57 of their brief, they cite you to a website of one company that they claim is an entrant into this market. And if you follow that website and you look at the most recent news on that company's blog, you'll find that that company has declared a pause in its efforts to enter this market. It's reassessing. And similarly, with the testimony of that we cite on page 14 of our reply brief, that executive that we're citing there was talking about having made an initial effort to test out whether that company could compete in this market and having withdrawn from that effort or retreated from that effort and decided, oh, we'll carry a few convenience items. We like the idea that a customer who is going to two different stores anyhow might pick up an organic apple from us rather than Whole Foods. We'll have it there as a convenience. It's not that we're going toe-to-toe with them. They're too special and unique. And then in the joint appendix at page 330, you'll see some email traffic dealing with Whole Foods executives looking at what happened when another major conventional chain tried to set out its own premium natural and organic set of markets. And in the words of one of the Whole Foods executives, another one bites the dust. So the newest evidence indicates that there have been efforts to enter this market, there have been efforts to reposition, but they have not produced any predictable effect on competition in the premium natural and organics market, and in fact that the evidence indicates that any kind of entry or repositioning isn't sufficient, won't be sufficient, at least not in any kind of time.
Why do the companies price check against one another?
I'm sorry?
Why do the companies price check against one another?
They price check against one another to see, as I was indicating earlier, they principally price check those items that they understand customers are price checking themselves.
But you're not alleging that the market is only the products within the market.
No, Your Honor, I'm not. What we
so
are alleging
problem,
is
right?
No, Your Honor. Like any other differentiated product, the premium natural and organic supermarkets market contains all sorts of attributes, qualities, and so on that these companies have tried to put together, as Your Honor was indicating, make a new product, a differentiated product, make themselves separate, so that in the minds of consumers there will be something new to try and something to become loyal to. And it is the totality of the offering, which may include competitively priced gallons of milk, but it also includes atmosphere. It also includes the commitment not to sell nasty, polluting products. They pride themselves in not selling Coca-Cola or not selling Tide. And all those things taken together is what we allege to be the relevant product market and to be the universe of uniquely close competition in which to look at the direct effects.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.